Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening. Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast. Today, our guest is Dr. Robin K. Dorr. She's a board-certified rheumatologist in private practice in Tustin, California, and a clinical professor of medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. She is also certified as a clinical densitometrist by the International Society for Clinical Densitometry. Dr. Dorr currently serves as the local chapter co-chair of the Association of Women in Rheumatology. And among her previous roles, she served as a past chair of the Southern California chapter of the Arthritis Foundation, past president of the Southern California Rheumatology Society, and a past member of the board of directors of the American College of Rheumatology. She is recognized widely for her contributions to patient and physician education and community service, including the development of Bone Builders, a program devoted to educating girls and young women about the importance of healthy lifestyles in the prevention of osteoporosis. She's a clinical investigator and participates in research studies of medication for treatment of gout, osteoarthritis, osteoporosis, rheumatoid, and other diseases. She has investigated multiple phase trials over her 30 years, and we are excited to welcome her today with all of that experience to talk about navigating the healthcare system and access to treatment and the journey with insurance companies. Like this. Dr. Dorr, welcome.
Thank you.
How are you today?
I'm excited to do this. It's certainly something that I deal with every day as having my own private practice and prescribing a lot of medications that the insurance companies try to not allow patients to have. And I've certainly been involved with my different positions in advocating to Congress and to Medicare to try to have better coverage for medicines, and hit my head against the wall many times, and have been a past member of ATAP, which is an organization trying to have more transparency when dealing with the middleman who oftentimes try to deny coverage for our patients, the PBMs. So I've had many hats. Again, as you said, now I'm on the board of directors of the National Arthritis Foundation, and am on the past president of the California Rheumatology Association. So very, involved in advocacy, and I'm on the advocacy committee for the Spondylitis Association of America as well. So we can have lots of great medicines to help treat in these conditions, but if the patients don't have access to the new medications, it doesn't matter.
Right. And we appreciate your service here at SAA on the advocacy committee. It's been an exciting and growing committee that has been doing more and more good work. We just were hearing an update the other day. So, we've got this. Having a chronic disease is complicated and not always easy for the patient. But I guess first, to pull back for like 10,000 feet in your universe, what are the biggest overarching challenges you see that patients have from your perspective, which we'll asterisk and say may not be the perspective of the organizations in which you are associated with. But what are the biggest challenges you see? And it's a very emotional frustration sometimes too.
Oh, it's extremely frustrating. The problem is, as you stated, that people with chronic diseases oftentimes are overwhelmed by the impact of the chronic disease on their home life and on their work, and can't really advocate for themselves. And so that's a burden right there. Also, there's the problem, of course, of having insurance to begin with. And, if people are working, hopefully they'll have insurance through their employers. But if they're not working, then they have to navigate whether it's Obamacare or some other individual insurance, that the policy could either be very restrictive or too expensive for them. And of course, there's also Medicaid. And here in California, at least this last year, very surprising, it was fairly easy to get biologic therapies for the Medi-Cal patients. But I have been told that that's going to change because the governor wants to take money away from Medi-Cal and help to use it to pay down the deficit. So again, there's a limited access. And then of course there's the patient eligible for Medicare, whether that's through disability or because they turn 65. And then there's Medicare and Medicare Advantage plans, as Gary Feldman, who's the current president of the CSRO, which is a state rheumatology organization, he calls the Medicare disadvantage plans, because if a patient must choose a Medicare Advantage plan, that their access to biologic and JAK therapies is extremely limited by the amount of copay that the patients must pay. And also, if the patient's receiving an infusible medicine through Medicare, the rheumatologists are not reimbursed adequately, so they don't want to infuse those patients. So there's so many different barriers.
So this is, and it's a growing problem, right? And we've seen it particularly post-COVID. I mean, it was hard to deal with navigating the healthcare system prior, but I feel like in the last year or two, it's even gotten more difficult. Is there, from a practical standpoint, if you are sitting in the patient chair, thoughts on best approach or what actually has been successful?
Well, if you're like Victoria, who's a member of our advocacy committee for ankles for the Spondylitis Association of America, I mean, she has the time and commitment, and sometimes she has to spend 2 hours on the phone in order to get what she needs for control of her disease. Unfortunately, lots of people don't have the time or the energy to spend that 2 hours, and then asking the insurance company if they have a navigator that can help them. And on very large companies usually do have a navigator that helps patients with their insurance needs. Or if you're not lucky enough to have a navigator with your insurer, then if there's a friend or family member who can advocate for you if you don't have the time or energy. And then finally, there's the rheumatologist office. And certainly here, I advocate for the patients, and I've gone all the way to the Department of Justice and advocated for a Medicare patient to have a drug covered by Medicare Part D. Takes a lot of time. There are some rheumatologists who charge for that service. I certainly don't. And there are some rheumatologists that don't have the time or the financial ability to do that. One of my colleagues, Dr. Sammy Matias, who's the current president of the California Rheumatology Alliance, has two people in his office. He has two rheumatologists and three APPs. He has two employees that he pays for that spends their entire time getting authorization for patients' medications. So you have to be the advocate or have somebody else be your advocate. And finding that person sometimes can be very frustrating and even expensive in some cases.
Do you find, this is maybe in the weeds a bit, but it's only going to get more complex, right? And I know we've seen stuff with the PBMs, the pharmacy benefit managers, they're continuing to get more complex for the patient. Do you see headed in the direction of more docs using their own resources to help people get access to healthcare?
Oh, there's this ATAP committee is trying to have more transparency for the PBMs and what's happening with some of the rheumatology offices is that they're trying to actually act as a specialty pharmacy and dispense the medications directly in their offices. And that way is a way of bypassing the PBM so that you do the prior authorization, and then the insurance company sends the biologic or JAK therapy to the rheumatologist's office and they dispense it to the patient. There was just a law in California that unfortunately has not been passed yet that looks like it will allow local pharmacists rather than the big Aetnas and Cignas of the world, local pharmacists to ask, especially pharmacies. But unfortunately, it was dropped out of the bill for California to allow rheumatologists to act as their own specialty pharmacy. The way it works in California is that there's a two-year cycle. So we're hoping to bring that bill back before the legislature in California, and other states are doing the same. And Medi-Cal in California hasn't decided how they're going to handle that or not. But at least from the patient's point of view, they're much more likelihood of getting the medicine is if it's being dispensed at the rheumatologist's office. And then there's that middleman is not involved, so that approval should occur more rapidly if that is allowed to occur.
So is the overarching problem just the complexity of the healthcare system, or is it capitalism, or right? Because I imagine as we're talking through this, and I think about like the work that my rheumatologist's office has done to when I've had issues. And some of that is, of course, right? Like it's also privileged access to healthcare.
Very much so. And that's a very definite problem. So that I'm afraid that with this decrease in Medi-Cal funding, that fewer rheumatologists will be seeing Medi-Cal patients. When it comes to the Obamacare patients, oftentimes their deductible is very high and they cannot afford. And there's a deductible for the office visit and there's a deductible for the medication, and they can't afford those deductibles.
Right.
And very definitely this year, it's been the most difficult to obtain prior authorization. And part of that is the advent of biosimilars for some of the medications. And so what is now being required, some of the insurance companies are not covering brand name Humira. Right. And just it's off the table, even if a patient's been taking it for 20 years and doing well. And that is just unethical. And I've said that many times. And then each insurer has their own preferred biosimilar. And then the question is that patient going to be changed because it's cheaper to another biosimilar down the line? And we do not have safety or efficacy data in switching from one biosimilar to another. We have it from brand name to biosimilar, but not from one biosimilar to another. But that, and there's more and more biosimilars becoming available very soon. And that's complicated the matter. And it really is capitalism, as you've said. I don't do infusions in the office. And one of the places where I was sending people is a oncology suite. And because just for sticking the needle in the patient, the oncologists get paid more for sticking the needle into the arm of a patient with cancer than sticking the needle in an arm of a patient with ankylosing spondylitis, they stop seeing rheumatology patients. And so the
I'm speechless, and I'm never speechless.
Yeah, and so it's a definite problem. And so I've been trying to find a place to send my patients for their treatments, and every place, and I've tried five so far, and every place that I have called told me it's financial disincentive for them to inject my patients because Medicare does not pay them enough to inject my patients. And so I said, I understand. I have a little office and I have to pay my overhead. But right now, at the present time, the only place I can find to send my patients is our local hospital, which is not for profit. And they lose money every month, but they you know, will inject my patients, but it means that my patients might have to travel 20 or 15 miles in order to get their treatment because it didn't make financial sense for the other places that are closer to continue to administer medications to my patients.
And this is like frustrating as hell. I mean, I don't usually get this frustrated. And I can remember my pediatrician when my kids were babies. He used to say, I lose like $17 for every vaccine I give your kids. Mm-hmm. And I understand there are times, right, in business, right? Because, right, running a hospital, a office is business, that we make concessions for our customers. In this case, the patient. And we take a little bit of a loss or a low margin. But there is something about this healthcare system that does not, it's unforgivable to not allow someone to administer healthcare because someone else is protecting their margins.
And unfortunately, that's what other than the Medicaid, that's what our system is right now. And it's extremely frustrating. Medicare reduced the reimbursement for me for seeing new patients. And a lot of people are not seeing Medicare new patients because of that. So there's an access problem. And another access problem is because there is that shortage of rheumatologists, that a lot of rheumatologists are screening patients when they call for a new patient appointment. And so if a patient says, you know, they have back pain, a lot of rheumatologists aren't seeing back pain. And so if a patient's calling, they have to say specifically, I'm being referred for either I have ankylosing spondylitis or I'm being evaluated to see if I have a spondyloarthropathy. But if they call and say to the person who answers the phone, I need an appointment to be evaluated for back pain, they probably won't be seen. So that just there's the insurance part of it. There's the medication coverage part of it. There's the access to a rheumatologist in general, and then saying the right thing when you call to schedule the rheumatology appointment.
And there are, okay, so that is something we should definitely, like, I think we pause and talk about the importance of that. When you are someone who is suffering, right, you may be at your primary care and they say, I want to have you see a rheumatologist. Have you seen a rheumatologist? Mm-hmm. And this is my story, and I'm sure millions of other people's. My GP was probably thinking AS, or I think psoriatic arthritis or something, but never said to me, right? Because what doctor generally isn't going to tell you if they're like just on a hunch and they're sending you to a specialist because they don't really know. So how in the name are you able to call and say, I need to be evaluated by a rheumatologist? We wouldn't need rheumatologists if we already had the diagnosis when we called. Right.
Well, you're right. I mean, and that's why it's so important
that
you say evaluation for ankylosing spondylitis, or perhaps the rheumatologist retired or is not taking the patient's insurance anymore. So they have a diagnosis, but they don't have access to that rheumatologist. So again, they need to call the other rheumatology office and say, you know, I have ankylosing spondylitis. I can't see my other rheumatologist for whatever reason, and I need an appointment fairly soon because, you know, I need my medicine refilled or I need my infusion. And that's where, again, being that advocate for yourself is so important. 2 years ago here in Orange County, we lost three rheumatologists who all quit at the same time. They were employed by a healthcare system and got fed up. The healthcare system made no accommodations for the patients. I was seeing those patients on a weekend to get them their biologic therapy until the health system could hire three more rheumatologists. So the problem is just, it's so complex and there's so many different levels. And one thing, if you are being evaluated for ankylosing spondylitis, or if you have the diagnosis and have lost access to treatment, again, contacting the Spondylitis Association of America and find out a list of rheumatologists who have an interest in treating this condition. Because again, a lot of times rheumatologists will want the RA or lupus patient, and they might not want the AS patient, especially when we're talking about non-radiographic axial spondyloarthropathy, which affects primarily women, and the women, for reasons we don't understand, are more disabled than the men with this condition. A lot of the rheumatologists don't want to deal with that problem with quality of life. That is, you know, you don't see it, you can measure it, which is what I do, but it takes a lot of time. And a lot of the rheumatologists, I mean, I had a patient that I saw Saturday who was changing rheumatologists. This patient had been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. The rheumatologist never examined her. I could see from across the room, she did not have rheumatoid arthritis. So there's the access, there's getting into the person who has an interest in ankylosing spondylitis. And then the health system often tells the rheumatologist how long they can spend with the patient. And right. So I think that was a problem here. He looked at her hands and goes, your hands are swollen, you have RA, you know, let me order some blood tests. Didn't even order any x-rays. And let's go from there. And so it's really an overwhelming problem and getting worse. And the patients need to advocate. And from my, you know, point of view, the rheumatologists need to advocate as well. And the family has to understand. And that's a problem with rheumatoid arthritis. I mean, at least people, family members, friends can see swollen hands. Well, if you just have ankylosing spondylitis and you don't have psoriatic arthritis, then, right. You know, you have back pain, you can't move. And, right. You know, the family or friends will say, well, everybody, you know, has back pain, everybody can't move, and they don't understand how disabling this condition is.
I'm rarely speechless, but today I am, because I think I want to get to a point where you and I get into like there being solutions. And in my head, I've thought about this many times. Like, I'm in here trying to figure out how do you wrap your arms around this problem and like create a business model that is successful. Because this is really problematic. So from a prior auth standpoint or getting access to medication, who is successful?
Certainly someone like Victoria, who's on the advocacy committee, because she stays on the phone and asks, can I speak to the supervisor? And if this, right. I mean, she's told the supervisor is not available, and they will, you know, they will call you back. So you have to have the time. If you get a no, you have to keep on, you know, going over that person's head and then asking that person, you know, if they can't give the prior authorization, what else needs to be done. If the person, going back to when we talked about choice of insurance, if the person has a choice of insurance, then looking at a list of medicines that insurance will approve, of course, all with prior authorizations because they're so outrageously expensive.
Right.
But if they can look at that list and see, oh gosh, this and this medicine are, you know, approved for ankylosing spondylitis, I'll choose this insurance. And as a patient I saw, you know, yesterday said, you know, they have the privilege of they can afford to pay $188 a month for the husband and $188 a month for the wife to have good medication coverage. But a lot of 80-year-olds don't have that disposable income to be able to have that access to medications. And especially when we look at the Medicare and Medicare Advantage system, it's very complex. And yet you have a person who's getting older who, you know, I get frustrated more easily, and it's too complicated for them. And I tell patients every day, it shouldn't be this hard to take care of patients. But I really don't know, you know, the business model, because I'm in my own you know, little office, and we work very hard to get what's right for the patients. But when you look at the data, at least in California, 75% of the rheumatologists now are employed by a corporate entity. Those corporate entities tell them how long to spend with the patient and what medicines they can approve, what tests they can order. So that means there's only 25% of us that can be there and really fight for the patient without right. someone hanging over our head saying, you need to do this, this, and this.
Right. And you can only be in the room for 6 minutes and 32 seconds. And
I think for the specialist, I think it's 15, but you know.
Okay. Fair.
certainly not long enough when we know the things like social stress, financial stress can affect how a patient does. And here the whole system is making the financial stress worse. And I can't do anything about their financial stress. Exactly.
Yeah. And then you go, can, it's because I always think of like, at the end of the day, we're paying it it's like being double taxed, right?
Yes.
Because as the patient, we're like, we're not probably getting in some cases the standard of care, but we're also somehow contributing to like some of those corporations having like record margins because they figured out how to operationalize and reduce and cost control.
That's exactly right.
Let's hope we're just invested in those companies and our pension funds and that we actually get a return on investment there.
Yes, I sure hope so.
So, okay. So let's talk a little bit about advocacy. You are working on the Spondylitis Advocacy Committee or Spondylitis Association's Advocacy Committee. Can you talk a little bit about what you guys are up to? And I think is there some crossover with other organizations?
Yes. And so certainly because, you know, I'm involved with, again, the Arthritis Foundation and the California Rheumatology Alliance, the Spondylitis Association of America Advocacy Committee is working along with those other organizations with regards to advocacy, again, access to medicines. Then there's accumulator plans. It's a whole other story where the copay yes. cards that you use, they're not allowing that money to go towards your deductible. So again, our advocacy committee is working with these other groups to try to, it's called Make Copay Count. And it's yep. trying to, you know, again, have the money that the patients pay as a copay go towards their deductible. So again, the medications can be more affordable. Victoria has actually has something online where she, you know, can teach patients how to be their own advocates. And again, working with, again, ATAP, the group for transparency with regards to PBMs. And then we went to Sacramento in May to talk to the legislators there and took patients with us. And then they could explain to their legislator, you know, what their condition was, because legislators have heard of RA and lupus, but most of them, you know, haven't heard about ankylosing spondylitis.
Right.
And so we spent most of the time educating the legislators about the disease rather than getting to the topic of trying to have them cover the medicine, because they didn't understand why for back pain that you should need such expensive medication. So then you explain it's inflammatory back pain and have to, you know, explain some of the biology and why we need to do that. So it's a daunting task, and it's something, you know, that obviously the Spondylitis Association of America has to do, but we've learned that in working with other groups, you know, we get more bang for our buck, we have more might that other groups might have ins with different people, and so that, you know, I think we're, it's just a matter, it's like hitting your head against the wall and continuing to go forward, and definitely the taking the patient with you so they can the legislator can see, you know, well, you know, I I developed AS when I was 16, and I've been on biologic therapy, and I'm now 30, and I can function as a normal individual. Again, that is impactful for the legislators, because they still look at us, you know, at doctors as being, you know, rich and, you know, profiting from seeing all these patients, and don't understand what the, you know, the healthcare system is really like today.
Yeah. While we were talking, while you're talking, I just was looking up, because one of my beliefs is that, like, there is some, with some of these, right, when you want to get something accomplished, there is so much noise out there. So I just looked at, this is going to, you're going to be interested. So I was looking at how has clinical research increased in the last 20, 25 years. There were over 491,000 clinical studies registered globally in 2024. In 2020, there were only 2,119.
Wow. Yeah.
And when you think about the we're all still fighting over the same number of senators, and we're fighting over the same number of representatives for the most part, and trying to grab the attention from an advocacy perspective, it's almost like we're just, the ability to amplify the voices in itself is very difficult to overcome. And I get what you mean. Like, you have to educate on the disease before you can educate on access to medication or all the other, right, the downstream effects. And I would love to explore, do we know how much government money, back pain, or undiagnosed?
No, I don't. I don't have those statistics on the top of my head. I do know, however, that, quote, back pain is the number one cause of disability in people who are working. Now, of course, how much of that is due to ankylosing spondylitis? How much is due to mechanical back pain? How much is due to degenerative disc disease? Those numbers haven't been broken out. But this is where it's important, again, if you have a large employer, what the Arthritis Foundation has now is something called Arthritis at Work, and where the employer can contact the Arthritis Foundation, and someone from the Arthritis Foundation actually goes out and educates about ankylosing spondylitis, rheumatoid arthritis, and other autoimmune and autoinflammatory conditions. So the employer can understand why it's important to get a good insurance, so the patients can be on therapy and continue to work. So again, the employer's understanding the condition, the legislators understanding the condition. You're exactly right that whoever is the decision maker needs to understand the condition first before we can then advocate for access to care and access to medication.
Very multidimensional. So advocacy, and I know if anyone listening is interested, there is on spondylitis.org, there's a lot of advocacy information, how to contact your representatives. So how can patients, getting involved, we just mentioned, and there's a lot of noise, but like, how do patients effectively communicate what they need? And do we need to do more research? Or I struggle because I'm a non-academic, right? So I'm always interested in like, how do you research to solve the problem commercially? But how do people effectively communicate this? And I think one of the things I learned that I'm not always good at, as you're trying to navigate it, right? You're already tired, you're already exhausted, you're not feeling well. You're probably, in many cases, again, like access to healthcare, or you're like financially, it's not great. But we get on the phone, and is the best thing to do just not take it personally? And just continue to chip away at it?
From my point of view, the spondylitis website is very good for educating patients, about their disease. In fact, I had of patients who had been diagnosed with ankylosing spondylitis by an orthopedic doctor probably 15 years before. And he didn't realize that there was, the orthopedist didn't at that time refer him to a rheumatologist. So he didn't know there was any medication that he could even take other than pain medicines and anti-inflammatories. He went to the Spondylitis Association website and saw, oh, there's something that can be done. And then, you know, he asked the ortho for the referral to me, and he was shocked that there were actually medications used, you know, to treat ankylosing spondylitis. So again, you know, it's getting, you know, people to the website. And so I'm, you know, that's, but you're right. There's, you know, well, the patient will say, well, I did my own research and I don't want to take that. And I see these commercials on TV and I don't want to die from that medication. And so certainly if they get into the rheumatologist and they are diagnosed with a spondyloarthropathy, asking the rheumatologist or the APP what website they recommend to get information from, I think can be very helpful. But just, you know, going online and Googling ankylosing spondylitis or Googling the medications, you know, patients will see a lot of chats that are going on about side effects of medicine, whereas I know in the clinical trials that I have done that those side effects occurred the same in the placebo group as in the treatment group. But again, when you're reading, you know, people's comments online, you know, you don't have that background information. So I try to discourage patients unless it's, again, a validated chat group, like something through the Spondylitis Association, to try, or there's other ones like Creaky Joints. They have very good chats going on. The Arthritis Foundation is just getting involved with that. So again, if it's an organization that's dedicated to the spondyloarthropathies, then that they will have, from my point of view, much more accurate information than just going online and finding whatever you find.
And I think you hit on something super important there. As we say in my house, Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram are not a primary source of information. And I think there's this crossover of, right, we wouldn't, there are so many places in our lives we wouldn't trust Facebook to dictate what decisions we're going to make. And I've seen it too in some of the, like, I'm not going to pick on Facebook, but in some chat rooms where there's a lot of, we'll call it misinformation or very individualized reporting. And then people take that back as what the research says.
Well, very definitely. I had a patient who came in and said, I read online that this happens. And I said, I did those clinical trials. I do not remember that in the clinical trials, but let me reach out to the medical scientific folks at the company and see what they say. And again, they had no data at all with regards to what the patient had said. So somebody online had said this, and then it got amplified by lots of other people that had seen it. And there was no factual basis for this at all.
Right.
But there again, we get to where the patient has to feel comfortable and the rheumatologist has to have the time to answer the patient's questions. Because if the patient bases their information on what they see, you know, in a chat room or online, and they either don't feel comfortable to run it by the rheumatologist or the rheumatologist doesn't give them time to say anything, then they're going to be fearful of the medication that the rheumatologist recommended. And that means they might not take it or they might not take it the way they should. And then it's not going to work. So I tell patients, ignorance is not bliss. You need to ask me and I need to answer those questions, because if your questions aren't answered, you might not be a compliant patient. And then I'm not doing what I need to do in order to get you better. And I tell people, if you don't believe what I say or you don't trust me, then you should go find another rheumatologist, because that patient rheumatologist connection is so important to get the patient better. So even if they have access to medicine, the fears about the side effect of the medicine and what they read online can make it so they're not going to be compliant, and then the medicine doesn't work because they're not taking it properly.
Right. No, it's tricky. Let me ask you this, actually. You touched on something that's of high interest to me, which is when there is a discussion about a medication or somebody comes in and says, well, I heard this, and you mentioned like being in a clinical trial, right? All of these larger, and I think this is, I don't know too much about it, but I think this is one place where maybe there's hope, is this connection of the medical science liaisons between the doctor's offices. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the more fascinating areas that could be, could help some of the patients. I don't think they're utilized enough, probably by doctors. I know there is also a problem where if you aren't a private practice, you have a harder time getting a response from the MSL, and like the medical science person in the pharma company, I hear. But this goes to access to healthcare. There's some really interesting like solutions going on in that area, which I wonder if those can bring maybe a little bit of relief. But yeah.
And again, that certainly from my point of view, I'm a private practitioner, and yet I deal with the medical science liaisons all the time. But they tell me that a lot of, whether it's academic or private practice rheumatologists, don't make the time to meet with them. And I will tell you, just in general, I mean, we, I guess 4 weeks ago, we had our California Rheumatology Alliance annual meeting. Fabulous speakers, and you know, including you know, a couple speaking about the spondyloarthropathies. And this was the whole state of California. And I think there were only 32 rheumatologists who came. So here you have access, expensive hotel room. It was in San Francisco, but you have access to up-to-date new information. And yet nobody, you know, very few people took, rheumatologists took advantage of that. And it wasn't like they were online. They weren't there virtually either.
Yeah.
So what I've seen since the pandemic, unfortunately, you'd think, oh, people would have extra time. They'd be, you know, looking at things online and learning more. But that's actually not what I'm seeing. People realize, oh, I've got all this free time. I'm going to do, you know, go hiking and do, I mean, the things that are important for our own rheumatology mental health. But taking advantage of medical knowledge that's available, I'm just not seeing a lot of rheumatologists who have, you know, the time or take the time for that new information. And that's been, you know, very discouraging for me. I'm lucky enough in that, you know, I've been around a lot and do a lot of, you know, patient as well as provider education. So that, you know, if I'm, you know, speaking for the Northern California Rheumatology Society next week sometime. And so people are coming because, you know, it's me. But if you have somebody that the audience isn't aware of, even if they're presenting exciting new information, they probably won't come. So again, it just complicates the matter even more that certainly, as you mentioned, there are many fewer clinical trials, but compared to rheumatoid arthritis, we have had more new medicines for the spondyloarthropathies than we have had for RA in the last 3 years. And so that again, there has to be that provider education about when these medications are appropriate to use in order for the providers to feel comfortable prescribing them.
Sure. And you're right, right? There's, to me, this goes back to like the noise in the world. We're all so connected, we're disconnected. Mm-hmm. But when you think about groundbreaking things, I mean, we saw at the Unmet Needs Conference last fall in DC for spondyloarthritis, some really groundbreaking technologies, great opportunities to for deeper research. SAA did a wonderful job. I would have liked to have seen that room filled and standing room only.
Yeah.
And it's a very strange, it is a strange phenomenon, but I think too, there's also, there's only going to be a certain number that will go in on like the crazy idea or it gets like researched to the nth degree. And I think there are some things, I mean, I know there's right? Research for medical is a little bit different, but I think there are some like really fascinating technologies out there, new ways of thinking with all of the, with all of the advancements we've had in science in the last 20 or 30 years, we should be glomming on to.
Exactly. And it, from my point of view, it's very exciting. The first weekend in September, Alvin Wells and Oren Trumm, two very well-known rheumatologists, are having a weekend symposium in Chicago that's going to be talking about using new technology in treating our patients. And so I hope that a lot of people will come. I've certainly signed up, but this is, you know, it's there. And again, you know, that we need to embrace that and how we can certainly take better care of our patients and use every technology and new information that's available. And that's one thing I didn't mention when we were talking about access to healthcare is if a patient has a spondyloarthropathy and is either underinsured or not insured, they should go to clinicaltrials.gov and find clinical trials in their area that are being conducted for their condition. Since the pandemic, many of these clinical trials can now be done virtually rather than in person. So again, that or somebody who's, let's say, failed all available medications for spondyloarthropathy, and they can find a clinical trial that they might qualify for. So there's always that option. And I do clinical trials in my office. Most of the academic centers do clinical trials. So that's just a way to get access to, you know, the most up-to-date medicine. And again, it's irrespective of if, you know, if you have insurance, don't have insurance, you get paid to come in for the visits. And it's usually the patients do extremely well just because they have access. They have the time spent with the clinical trial coordinator, and they feel that they are, you know, participating in helping new medications come to the market.
Right, right. Okay, so first, how can a girl get a ticket to that in September? That's fascinating.
It's called the ART Symposium, the first one in September.
I do like to do these things with my weekends. I'm going to look it up. All right, we have very few minutes left because you are on the West Coast and you have come in very early to talk to us before your patients. Any last moments of hope, inspiration, encouragement when it comes to navigating the healthcare system?
Yes, and that there are certainly tools available to help the patients advocate for themselves. If they have the availability to, you know, choose a, you know, rheumatologist who has an interest, an expertise in either ankylosing spondylitis or somebody they've talked to their friends and is willing, you know, to advocate for them, that's extremely important. That patients with AS, because of the expense of the medicines, need to have insurance and realize it's not just back pain, but it's inflammatory back pain. And we have medicines that can help, because a lot of the patients will tell me, well, I just thought it was back pain. And even though I knew it was ankylosing spondylitis, I didn't know there was anything that could be done. So I didn't think I needed insurance. So that just that education about there are medications that can significantly improve patients' quality of life. And you need to be able to have access to that. And there are certainly many not-for-profit groups that you could find online that will help you find insurance to try to meet your needs if you're not able to work. And that's the other thing that I didn't mention is that if patients are not able to work, but they were working in the past, that they can apply for Social Security disability. And if they've been unable to work for 2 years, they can apply for Medicare. And then that will give them, you know, access to the rheumatologist and to the medicines if they get a Medicare Part D plan. So there are ways around the access and treatment issue, but the patient needs to be educated, and certainly our legislators need to be educated. So anyone who's interested, again, in getting online and sending emails to their representative, either in Congress or in their state, that makes a difference, because they're the people that vote them in. And yep. So that I think that's really the best way that patients can fight for the right for treatment, is by being their own advocate. But again, as we've both said, it's exhausting and time consuming. Yes.
Well, our time is up, Dr. Doerr. Thank you so much. I would love to have you back for part two. And deeply appreciate your commitment to people with ankylosing spondylitis and spondyloarthritis. We really appreciate you, I think, on behalf of everybody, including SAA and the listeners.
Well, thank you very much. This is something that I deal with every day, and talk to my receptionist, who also helps me with the prior authorizations. And she said, well, maybe I should be on there and talk to them. I go, another time, Pilar.
You know what? That might actually be a great idea, right? Because she's got the tactical approach.
Yes, right? She does.
Yeah,
she
okay.
Does. Thank you very much. Have a good
thank you. Have a wonderful day. Wonderful week.
Thank you.
Good trip.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.